It's all the files of the whole park. It tells you everything.
Sir, he's uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
You know, in this age of social collapse and plague, it's easy to forget that the 2016 presidential election was a clusterfuck of gargantuan proportions. Russian spies, WikiLeaks, war in Ukraine, Mueller report, election interference, all spelling maybe the first chapter in the end of the American experiment? Well, HBO has a great new doc deep diving this entire ordeal. Co-directed by film great Alex Gibney and Javier Alberto Botero, Agents of Chaos is a doc that parses exactly what happened to America during what's become the most insane election ever, at least so far. Botero is on the show to tell me more. I'm Ben Maku, and this is Cyber. All right, so Javier, I covered this pretty closely in Russia as well. I was there for a bit, the DNC hack and all of the sort of espionage intrigue surrounding it. I felt like it was a massive rabbit hole. You spent 3.5 years doing this. How do you feel?
So I'm curious. I can't deny there are many rabbit holes. You know, there's a war in here. What part to you, as someone who covered it, feels like the rabbit hole? Is it the whole thing? Is it the notion of Russian interference in the election 2016, or was it those hacks particularly?
Okay, so I have to tell you, the troll factory stuff, I could give almost less of a shit about. Because I thought that was the one that was so difficult to really gauge and measure how effective it really was. Even though, I mean, I would say it was clearly effective, but it was, you know, the hardest one to put an actual metric on like how far did some of this influence operation, how did it actually affect the election, the vote. To me, the insane rabbit hole of it was basically, I mean, the hack and dump, and then the coordination between Manafort and I mean, you gesture towards this in the film, and the Kremlin to some extent. Because when I was covering the hack originally, I just spent a bunch of time covering the war in Eastern Ukraine, and it was just so obvious that the Kremlin had been meddling there. And, you know, you had the little green men and you had the Russian-backed separatists, but also the name Manafort popped up with Yanukovych. And then to see him become campaign manager, it was just sort of like, well, this is now obvious that there's connections to the Kremlin. Because if you look at someone like Yanukovych and who they were to the Kremlin, and Manafort being that close, it immediately became insane to me. So the rabbit hole was, I think, just how far this got and how that salient point didn't even register with the public of how close this individual was to like real Russian power brokers. So I mean, that my short answer was that the Manafort, Klimnik, all that rabbit hole was, I think it was just such a smoking gun.
Yeah, that's funny that you were in that position to be able to see that right away. You know, as were a handful of people who were aware of what of Manafort's history. I say a handful. You know, we're talking about probably a few dozen people in the U.S. who had been following what was going on in Ukraine in the years leading up to 2016, and were aware of who Paul Manafort was and what he had been doing out there for a decade at that point. You know, we have a few of those people in our film who have the same reaction that you did. So it's funny that you had that sort of like immediate recognition of, oh my God, this guy is the campaign manager. Don't people realize like who he is and what his connections are to Russia, especially when, you know, that's happening right around the same time that you have this sort of this brewing awareness. Of course, Manafort became the campaign manager before the hacks became public, but, you know, not that long before, and certainly sort of was still rising to prominence in the campaign later in the summer. And, you know, it was just he seemed like the last person you would want running your campaign if there were, you know, brewing suspicions that your campaign might be a pawn of the Kremlin, right? And it turns out that, you know, he had this, yeah, very strange relationship with people very close to the Kremlin. I think it's you talk about the rabbit hole. You know, even just in the last, you know, 2 minutes, we're talking about trolls. We're talking about Paul Manafort and these personal relationships he has to people in power in Russia. We're talking about hackers. there's so many different components that came together. One of the hard things about the rabbit hole of this story is that you start going down it. I'm sure you found this in your reporting too. You start going down it and suddenly there's a fork and there's another fork and there's another fork. And then you think, well, I'm going down to the right, but now it feels like I'm back in the same tunnel I was in before. It's what this story still seems that way to me, where the tunnels all intersect. You're not quite sure how building that sort of 3D map of what all of this you know, rabbit warren looks like is kind of impossible. But what we can do is we can identify the big kind of like, you know, the big thoroughfares. And I think the big thoroughfares are those three that I just outlined and which we in the film have as different sections. I think you have, you know, these different prongs of the Russian interference in 2016. And one of the things we try to do with the film is to present this, is to take it out of the world of the rabbit hole. You know, we chase down a lot of details. We dig into a lot of we dig into all the details of the stories, but we try to do it within this framework that can help people actually understand what happened in 2016, understand how, you know, who did what, but why we should care about it. How we should actually understand, you know, what we should be thinking about for, you know, elections to come in terms of not just interference, but in terms of other people, other political actors taking advantage of the same vulnerabilities that Russia took advantage of in 2016 to have an influence in our country.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I have to say, this is probably one of the, I think it might be the best overview I've seen of this whole fiasco. I think in part because you don't seem to fall into the trap of really playing the politics of this. I think the things you the film really established as well, that's my takeaways as well, is that, you know, the Mueller report is actually quite damning. There are some things in it that are really that don't come to full conclusions on collusion, but it's very damning. And then the stuff that it was clearly trying to prove was obstruction of justice, which it does, but none of this lands well because everyone wanted this sort of Manchurian candidate. But in the end, the swamp that actually was surrounding it was really the takeaway. And this is clearly a problem for our democracy going forward. And I think you did that really, really well. Cause I think that's the thing, is that this event was so insane. And now we're looking at it, you know, with retrospectively, and I don't think we're like fully aware of just how insane it was.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. I think it's, the narrative sort of took off in so many different directions after 2016. You know, there was that sort of, you know, everybody, I feel like you can divide up everybody into three camps, basically, when it comes to the story. You know, you got one side that follows the sort of President Trump line, right? It's a witch hunt. It's a hoax. It was all made up. It was a Democratic plot. On the other side, you have Manchurian candidate. Trump is in bed with Putin. We're going to find the damning, you know, emails at some point. And the third group is a group of people who are not sure what really to believe. They know something happened, but was it really a big deal? It's kind of hard to tell. There are 100 different stories, and I was never really quite sure how they all fit together. And the last, and I kind of don't want to think about it anymore. And you know, I think it's sad because when you look at what actually happened in 2016, it's impossible to really map out all of those rabbit holes that we talked about. It's impossible to, you know, I don't expect that anyone will go and, you know, memorize every last page of the Mueller report and know exactly what happened there, or let alone the, you know, Senate report that followed up that has its 1600 pages or whatever, you know, a little appendix on Mueller. But I don't think it's hard to step back and take a broader look at what happened, what a foreign country tried to do to us, to our political system, what we allowed to have happen, and to just at that broad level, you know, understand that. And if you do actually understand that what happened broadly, you know, I don't understand how someone cannot feel outrage about what happened. The fact that so many people in our country don't have that sense of outrage about what happened in 2016, I think is one of the, you know, it was one of the driving reasons for this film. ending up as you know, where we did with it. You know, we worked on it for a long time. We considered a lot of different approaches, but I think in the end, it made sense to give that broad picture, to do that recap of what happened. And we chose, I mean, very specifically to focus on, to stop the story. You know, we have a little epilogue at the end, but we end the story at Election Day 2016, largely speaking. We wanted to tell the story of what actually happened in that election with this interference, and to not get lost in all the details of what happened afterwards, because, you know, that's almost been lost in the political fighting of the last few years, right? Everyone trying to
completely
really throw down on their interpretation of what happened and dividing into these camps. And it's like, let's go back to what actually happened. Let's just look at the facts of 2016 and consider it anew. And if at the end of that, you're not outraged, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know what your allegiance is to our political system at that point, right?
Well, that's the thing. Because the facts of it, it was a complete successful attack by a very belligerent foreign power that at the time there were major flashpoints all over the world with it, and that has completely been lost, like you said. And now we're looking back at the same system, and you know, it's 2020 now. You know, we're like a month and a bit away from the next presidential election, and have we solved any of the problems that were outlined in the documentary that you just made?
Yeah, this is the remarkable thing, right? About the fact that the country spent so many years debating what happened in 2016, and yet, you know, largely there's a consensus. I don't think people need to watch our film necessarily to believe this. There's a consensus that Russia did interfere in the election. I think it's the lack of understanding that how profound that interference was that's caused the problem, because even though there's a consensus that Russia didn't interfere in the election, you don't seem to see a whole lot of outrage, you know, about the fact that they're interfering again. That's been confirmed. You know, the Trump administration has confirmed that Russia's interfering in the election. You know, they throw on there like, oh, you know, China's interfering too, and Iran is interfering too. You know, the reporting is making it pretty clear that Russia is the big problem again.
Yeah,
it's not China and Iran. Those are, of course, President Trump's hobby horses, and needs to keep throwing them out there.
Well, it's also the other thing we have to remember as well. It's like, I think certainly you'll see some of these, you know, influence operations of, you know, troll farms, et cetera, and some of these bigger accounts. But I think the bigger thing you're also going to see is, I mean, I think it was around the time that some of the Burisma stuff had come out about Joe Biden's son. There had been reportedly, you know, and verified by some cybersecurity companies, attacks against Burisma coming from Russia. And I keep thinking about that, like the Trump administration or the Trump campaign hasn't used that yet. So what's coming next? Because in 2016, you know, you have that, you cover well that infamous line where he says, you know, Russia, if you're listening, find Clinton's emails, kind of calling the shot of another dump. And now, like, we're a month and a bit away, there's still some time for another dump of something else that, you know, we're not foreseeing just yet.
Absolutely. And look, there are reports about this Ukrainian lawmaker who was passing documents over to journalists and to, you know, US US political figures trying to provide dirt on Biden. It's back to 2016. It's this you know, people, we talk so much about collusion over the last few years. And in the film, one of the things we tried to make clear was that it wasn't, if you're looking for that, you know, there's a great line from historian Timothy Snyder in our film about, you know, the fact that it's a mistake to look for the written document. I mean, he talks about how it's seduction, not collusion. Mm-hmm. I mean, another way to think about it is it's not really collusion when it's happening in the public eye. It absolutely is just, was just happening in the public eye. It was a call and response. It was, you know, Trump saying emails, 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 making clear that that's important. And suddenly we have emails that are connected to Hillary Clinton and the Democrats coming out that are a potent weapon. It's Roger Stone writing an article about how the election is going to be rigged at the same time that Donald Trump is talking about how there's going to be a rigged election. And Stone actually sends that article to Guccifer 2.0 and, you know, highlights it. And then over the coming months, you have this campaign by Russian actors to help create evidence for a rigged election. A campaign that never really came to fruition because it didn't have to be. I mean, they were sitting on a bomb that never went off. It was a bomb that was intended to go off if Hillary Clinton won the election.
Well, that's the other thing too. I think you're right. I think it was intended for that. But then at the same time, you know, the one thing I remember talking to intelligence experts and people in the IC right after all this happened was it was a textbook disinformation or influence operation. Because most of all, what it did as its crux was led with the truth, right? It dumped these emails that showed that the Democratic, you know, the DNC was in fact corrupt in some ways and was propping up a candidate over another. And that to lead with that and then allow all other facets of it, of it be untrue is fine. But the first, you know, the top thing is it's relatively true. And I think that that's why it landed so well. That's another thing I think the doc brings up. It's that, you know, sure, Russian espionage worked really well and they hacked a bunch of candidates and stuff got dumped and blah, 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 and influence operations, et cetera. But also, you know, there was a ready and receiving audience that ran with the whole thing. And if we weren't weakened in that way, then maybe it wouldn't have worked.
Yeah, it was definitely something that we tried to highlight. I think I think it's impossible to look at 2016 and look at the details of what the Russian government did. I think particularly the GRU hack and dump operation and not say that it had some impact on the election. Mm-hmm. I think with how close the election was, it was clearly there in the mix and contributed to Trump's victory.
Absolutely.
But it was in the mix for a very messy election, a sort of perfect storm of factors that I think broke in Trump's direction. And it was there. It was a substantial one. But I think, it as we, you know, say in the film, you know, it fell on very fertile ground here. It was really a very well tuned for being such a sloppy operation in a lot of ways and such a sort of shoot from the hip operation. It was very well tuned to have an impact in our incredibly dysfunctional and polarized, you know, political environment. It's incredible that it's an attack that continues to have an impact. It had an impact. And then it had a continued impact after the election in our debates over it, in that political polarization that we talked about, you know, the Manchurian candidate versus the witch hunt, right? That chaos that was caused continues to be caused. And it's paid incredible dividends. It's a remarkably effective attack when you consider that the number one goal was not make Donald Trump president, but destabilize the United States, cause chaos there.
Absolutely. Now for you doing this whole film in Russia, how was it? Was it difficult to work there? Were you ever getting any trouble from any unnamed individuals who kept following you? If you know what I'm getting at?
Had a few. So I spent a few months in Russia in total, in Russia and in Ukraine. You know, for the most part, we obviously, this wasn't our first time at the rodeo, and we took a lot of precautions. We were very careful from day one. We were working with people in Russia, with some amazing journalists out there who helped us understand the environment. And you know, in part for ourselves, but also in large part for the people we worked with and for the sources we were working with, we were so careful from day one in terms of our approach. That said, anybody who knows anything about, you know, the Russian security services knows that it's kind of silly to go and work there and pretend you're not, you know, there's not a high possibility that you're being tracked, that potentially you're being tailed if you're that interesting. We had a few weird moments that I attribute to in terms of in-person encounters that I took as you know, early on there was a moment, I mean, just to get to it, there was a strange occasion where a three-star uniformed, you know, Russian army general sat down next to me on a long train ride and fell asleep with seemingly classified documents spilling out of his bag. I chose not to touch any of them. I thought, this is so silly that it at least confirms for me that we're not, if this is the entrapment it obviously seems to be, it confirms for me that you know, we're not seen as that big a risk because they put the B team on it. Because this is pretty bad. I know enough not to reach down and touch the classified papers, right? you know, but obviously the Russian intelligence services are world class. there aren't many countries that have their spying capabilities. Yeah. And domestically, right? I mean, like, it's a you know, they may be the top, right? It's really I was under no illusions when I was there that everything we did could be tracked. And so that was, yeah, there were circumstances that were hairy. I think the bigger concerns for us in country were when we were working on the troll farm and the Wagner stories, anything having to do with Yevgeny Prigozhin, who, you know, is connected to a number of cases of journalists being murdered, mm-hmm. including actually in Russia. And so I think that the greater concern was always for the people we were working with, the Russians we were working with, as foreign journalists. I think we had actually a bit more protection.
Some degree of protection because you get to leave.
Because we get to leave. Yeah. And because it's a bigger, you know, it becomes an international scandal when a foreign journalist is targeted, right? Especially someone, say, like Alex Gibney, right? If Alex mm-hmm. Gibney is, if something happens to him, it's an international cause celebre. If something happens to an amazing investigative journalist who we're working with, who works for like a local investigative paper in St. Petersburg, Russia, it's a story in Russia, but not necessarily a story anywhere else. And not, no, and you can't necessarily do anything about it at that point.
Because it's expected.
But it's expected, yeah. And so so we worried about that. Prigozhin is a thug. And there are too many cases of people.
And I mean, Wagner yeah. is just a pretty terrible. Wagner, every time I try to explain what Wagner is to some people, and for the uninitiated, it is essentially the Kremlin's version of Blackwater, the notorious mercenary outfit from the US that was, you know, implicated in all these war crimes. But Wagner is like an unleashed version of that, where they're connected to all sorts of things all over the world, including the murder of a few journalists in Central African Republic that just ambushed them. So it's a pretty nasty group of people. And this guy, he helped run them. And he also owned the troll farms.
Yeah, and I think the combination of these things is actually something that people haven't realized the full impact of yet. It's not something, you know, we didn't have Russian tanks rolling into down the streets of DC in 2016, right? We only had the trolling part of the operation, but we didn't have that mercenary group, the Wagner group. They've been very active in other in other places where the internet research agency trolls have been active. So in Ukraine, that's where Wagner sort of, you know, cut its teeth. In Ukraine and in Syria as well, the other sort of major theater of Russian conflict over the last decade. What you saw in both those countries and both those conflicts is, of course, that, you know, the IRA troll factory and the Wagner mercenary group, both of which are, you know, controlled in this Yevgeny Prigozhin network under his conquered sort of holding group. You know, there's some rough coordination in what they do. There's coordination in terms of the overall strategic goals. And sometimes it gets pretty granular. You know, it's not like the IRA trolls are sitting there talking every day to the mercenaries out in the field, but they're absolutely after the same goals and they support each other in what they do. It's that combination that people don't fully appreciate, and that we, unfortunately, which we didn't get a chance to really highlight enough in the film, because frankly, there are 500 things, you know, other things that didn't also got short shrift just by the nature of this massive story we were covering. One of the things that we saw in our research is just how much this has become an ongoing sort of concern, the IRA political manipulation plus Wagner conflict machine that is now being sold as sort of like a package deal in all of these countries. It's been primarily in Africa, but you have it being sold by Yevgeny Prigozhin's employees to people who want a sort of, conflict in a box, right? Hire yourself some trolls to create, to help drive wedges in between political groups, to help intensify political polarization and generate extra conflict. And, oh, well, you know, wouldn't it be helpful then to have some Russian mercenaries who come in and, you know, provide security in your country where this is happening? You know, we found this chilling map in some documents that were leaked to us of internal Prigozhin company strategy document where they were looking at unrecognized countries in Africa, basically splinter countries that could be broken off where they could cause civil wars.
That's insane.
It's insane. And this is going on right now.
It really is like some Bond level villain.
It absolutely is.
It's crazy. It seems like a plot from some ridiculous NatSec movie that I don't even think is going
to
be good.
It's absolutely what it is. It's hard to watch our movie look, just look at what happens in our movie in 2016, right? In our country. Imagine you went into a coma in 2015, and you wake up today and you watch our movie, right? It's the first, you know, obviously this is the first thing you're going to do. You've woken up from the coma and you have a sandwich and you sit up and turn on HBO on Wednesday and watch 4 hours of our film to catch up on what happened in 2016 and why Donald Trump is president. Imagine seeing all of that for the first time. Part of the reason it's not shocking is because we saw it came out in drips and drabs over 4 years, right? It's like a Bond. It is mm-hmm. like a Bond movie. It's like a Bond movie plus a Bourne movie plus, you know, War Games.
Plus Burn After Reading.
Plus Burn After Reading. Absolutely. Yeah.
The other thing too is that it's sort of, the whole thing is just, it completely played out like somewhat of a comedy of errors. And then also just this highly sophisticated spy film. And that's what really, I think that's what also in part fuels the, you know, the witch hunt versus Manchurian Candidate, is that on the one hand, this story is like so fantastic and ridiculous. And on the other, it's like very, it's like clearly Russian tradecraft, like Russian espionage tradecraft at its best. And sort of deciphering between those two thematic polar opposites is, I think it's really hard for people to understand. It's like, on the one hand, you're like, Trump's getting peed on or watching two prostitutes pee on a bed or whatever it is. And then the other, you do actually have Manafort having a really, you know, highly suspicious dinner with what we now know as a Russian intelligence officer.
Yeah.
So it kind of, it runs the gamut, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's that mix of incredibly suspicious sort of circumstances and characters who end up being sort of who end up being innocent, who end up being not important, who end up being just sort of clowns. And then these very savvy agents of chaos involved in the story, who were chasing after some, you know, usually chasing after, looking out for themselves and chasing after money, for the most part. You know, Paul Manafort certainly seems that he was trying to get his, you know, tens of millions of dollars in debt forgiven, right? He's in hock to a Russian oligarch, who had been chasing him down and looking for him. And suddenly he has something to sell, which is, once again, political access. And it's not the deal that's signed in blood that says that, you know, Donald Trump will follow orders from the Kremlin. It's you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's by design. You know what I mean? That's also great tradecraft.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it makes it utterly deniable.
It's the constant ability for the Kremlin to have plausible deniability over foreign operations.
Right. And the fact that it's the fact that we've done nothing about it, the fact that we have all of these facts. Again, you watch our film and you see all those, you see all the facts in one place, right? And I can't say that our film has every last story in it. It's just there's too much that we know about what happened in 2016 to possibly cover everything in the depth I would have wished. Having seen it, you know we cover a hell of a lot. And we cover the major pieces, and you get through the end of it. And, you know, the fact that you can watch through all of that, understand what happened, and then hear that there is interference happening today, you know, that Russia is at it again, that they were trying to do something in 2018, that they're at it in a major way in 2020. Oh, and by the way, other countries are interested too. And we don't have, it's not a national uproar. I mean, I think it will never stop being a shock to me. It is crazy to me that the Trump campaign would think that it was that the way to counter news about Russian interference in this coming election is by saying, well, look, China and Iran are doing it too on the other side, helping Biden. They should be, they're trying to highlight more interference. I mean, this should be like a national shame, national embarrassment. We have done so little to deter the country that that interfered in 2016 that now everybody's in on it. And that's
well, I mean, I mean, and that's where we're at. And I think that this entire period will be a national historic shame. Like it will be, I think once things settle, at some point, people are going to look back on how truly much of a clusterfuck this was and the damage it's done to not only American institutions, but its ability for deterrence, its ability to defend itself, et cetera.
I think that's right. And I think we're all going to feel our sense of shame of where we were in that and what part we played in the political polarization. And, you know, and I have always thought, you know, 2016 was, you know, we have, you know, or two political parties or two drunk guys at a bar, you know, and they're down in shots and getting in a fight, and suddenly the Russian bartender comes over and starts pouring shots, you know. It's not there was already a fight going on. Then they take the fight outside, yeah. And the Russian bartender stabs one of them in the back, you know. But it's there was already a fight happening. It was already we were already, I think, in a place where to be in a place where this could work against us, where these things could work, where they could continue to work, even though we already know about them.
Exactly.
Yeah, it is. You're absolutely right. We're going to look back with shame on this
absolutely
time period.
Well, thank you for coming on the show, Javier. And the doc's great. And I guess you must be looking forward to some well-earned time off.
I am. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for highlighting the film. I hope people enjoy it, and I hope especially that hope it gets out to people who haven't ever taken a look at the whole story. in one place, because I think it's important too.
Totally agree.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Mr. Lorenzo. Hello, how are you today?
Hello, Ben. It's great to talk to you again. It seems like we talked just yesterday. It's weird.
It's weird, right? It's almost like somebody in this gruesome twosome didn't record himself properly. So we're doing this for a second time.
It's because we care. We care about quality.
Quality control, my friends. Quality control. All right, so let's get to it. We're back on Cypher. You're back. It's been a 2-week hiatus. We're looking good now. We're in business. First story, a Jason Kepler classic, which is just to say basically him contacting Twitter, essentially trolling them. When Mr. Trump, our president, was diagnosed with COVID and people sort of erupted on that wonderful hellscape, making jokes about how the president will die and kind of hoping he would die.
Yeah, this is a great Jason Kepler classic because, you know, everyone on Twitter was talking about the news of last week, Donald Trump falling sick and getting COVID. And I don't know about you, but my timeline was filled with, you know, either news about it or mostly people joking about him dying and wishing him to die. And some of those jokes and memes were funny. Others were not so much. But yeah, this was basically the theme of the day on Twitter. And Jason was smart enough to think about, well, I wonder what Twitter thinks about this. Is this okay? Are they going to put a stop to this? What do they think? And Twitter responded pretty quickly and said that actually, no, this was against their rules and that they would either suspend accounts or delete tweets depending on the situation. And this was very confusing because... this is a new rule. You know, I'm sure it's happened to you many times. It's happened to me. It happens so much more often to women on Twitter. You know, everyone, like a lot of people wish death on other people and harass and abuse people verbally on Twitter. And not much happens to them. So it is a legitimate question. Why is Trump different? Is there a special rule for him?
Well, that's the thing. It's like how many people of color, trans people, journalists like myself, I've had death threats on Twitter. I've had tons of death threats on Twitter. Have gone through this, and this entire multi-billion-dollar Silicon Valley behemoth does nothing about it. But the minute Mr. Trump gets a joke about him potentially dying from COVID, you know, they're willing to change their entire way of doing things. Like just throw their terms of service out the window.
Yeah, it's very confusing. It just doesn't seem like they really have any criteria that they can go back to. You know, they have a set of rules, but every time something unexpected happens, they change the rules. So, you know, it really begs the question, does Silicon Valley really know how to moderate content on their own platforms? Do they have any idea what they're doing?
I agree completely. I mean, and you know, I wasn't one of the people making jokes about the potential death of Mr. Trump to COVID-19, just and only because I think it's, you know, well, it's bad juju, personally.
Yeah, and it's not our
job. It's also kind of your right if you're a comedian and you're sort of some sort of outspoken person on Twitter to make jokes like that. You know what I mean? That's not a real death threat. Like, come on. Like, I've seen real death threats sit on Twitter for days. I've received them myself. I'm sure you have as well. that's a big difference from making a crack about someone maybe dying of COVID-19 or otherwise. Like, that's, you know, it's not like, it's sure, it could be seen in bad taste, but it's not necessarily like a dangerous concept. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know why they needed to make this exception, really.
Yeah, I don't either. All right, here's another one. Another great individual who has a great Twitter presence, who completely and falsely accused a man of being a pedophile without any information whatsoever, just because he's a billionaire and he can. Elon Musk, he got rid of his communications or comms team, basically, at Tesla, one of the world's most valuable car companies. He basically iced the one department in the entire company that would deal with journalists and their questions, which is just like so classic Elon Petty Musk.
Yeah, this is much more, this is the kind of news that's a little bit easier to understand. In the last few years, it's become very clear that Elon Musk is one of those people that will scream fake news every time.
Yeah,
he thinks it's convenient, especially when there's a story he doesn't like. And this is just the last, just another step in that direction. He thinks that he's himself and his company don't need to be accountable to anyone. And he certainly does not want to be accountable to journalists. And it appears that that's why he canned his whole PR department. But I personally think this is going to backfire, because at some point, any company needs to interact with journalists. You know, it's not like just because you don't have a PR person anymore or a PR team, we will stop writing about your company. In fact, this may lead to more mistakes or coverage that will be even more negative, because they don't have they don't have a channel anymore to interact with the press. So everyone loses, I think.
Yeah, everyone loses. And also it's just like this like growing instance of Silicon Valley companies becoming these fascistic private entities that swear against, journalism and the right for people to know and to hold them accountable in any way possible. It's really insane when you see companies that are just, they do bad things and they seem totally shocked at the concept in which journalists would hold them accountable in any way possible. Like this is so classic Elon Musk. It's like, if you don't agree with what he's doing, you are literally the enemy. It's, it's right out of the Trump playbook.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the sad part about this. It's right out of the Trump playbook. And, perhaps I'm naive, but I really wish someone that, claims to want to make the world better, and as companies like Tesla and SpaceX focused on, in theory, a better future, would lead by example on something so basic like respecting freedom of speech and First Amendment. But
yeah, also another reason not to trust Elon Musk: guy doesn't inhale. Like, let's be honest, I've seen that clip.
Like, yeah, I don't think
that's the most narc. That's the most narc shit I've ever seen in my life. My life.
Indeed.
All right, so this is the final one. It's me now. I'm on the hot seat. All right.
Oh yeah, let's quickly exchange seats. Yeah. So yeah. Ben, tell me about this story. You and your colleague Mark and you and your usual team have a bombshell of a report here.
We do. We, Mac Lemmer and I, have prepared an 8,000 word feature, which pulls from court documents, internal sources, and thousands of records from the encrypted chat room of a neo-Nazi terror group called The Base. And we've essentially did an entire deep dive explaining the birth of this organization all the way to its current form, which is, somewhat unknown. But I will say this, this thing is crammed with so much information about how a domestic terrorist organization like The Base, with, Nazi ideologies, how it nearly created a stateside insurgency against the US government. And it was led by a man named Ronaldo Nazaro. It's pretty shocking. It's a pretty shocking story. It's really, I think it's quite well written. I think it's something y'all should pick up and give it a read, especially on a weekend. It's a good weekend read, I think.
Yeah, if you can really like sit with like it. almost like a beach read. It's too bad. It's maybe too late for that.
Exactly. Well, we're in social distancing season, so.
Yeah, but jokes apart, I mean, this sounds like a very hard story to pull off. Is there anything can you tell our listeners a little bit about how you guys even approached this story? How was it born and how did it get to this point?
So we've been covering the base for 2 years now. We broke the first ever story on this organization, sort of parallel group to Adam Waffen Division, which is another domestic terrorist organization. I've been covering terrorism now since 2013, actually, when I was with The Wire. And, you know, this is just an accumulation of sources inside of the group, ways in which I can fact check things through other sources. And just, you know, it's a compendium of information highways that Mac and I have and Zachary Kamel have been pouring over for the better part of the last 6 months. And it really does depend very much so on these thousands of records that we have, which is, you know, provides extremely damning information about the internal conversations that this group had and what they were planning. It gets so specific as to the types of terror attacks that they were considering doing, how the leader himself had framed terrorism as this sort of like semi-legal thing, always doing it in the hypothetical, the exchange of, you know, bomb making manuals to then finally you reach this point where there's this fine line between them being trolls and online talkers of mm-hmm. bullshit and terrorism, and it starts to actually get into the real world and you see them evolve into an actual IRL insurgency against the US government. And eventually the FBI made several raids across the country in January and February and arrested 7 or 8 of them. And now they're still members at large. There's still stories to be told around them. But yeah, I think if you're wondering what this looks like, if you're wondering what far-right terrorists look like, this is the story for you.
Yeah, sounds like a great place to start if you really want to understand what's going on in the U.S., mm-hmm. You know, with Donald Trump, refusing to condemn white supremacy, how dangerous that is. This is why. This is groups like this is why people need to pay attention and keep everyone accountable on that front.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Lozo, for the second time round. I'm sure I'll have you again 1,000 more times on this podcast.
Anytime. It's always my pleasure.
As usual, Forza Juve. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.